America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. We're broadcasting today live from Los Angeles in the studios of K-Talk, AM 1150, AM, our Los Angeles affiliate. And a little later on in the program, third hour of our program, Judge James L. Buckley is going to be with us, a former senator, undersecretary of state under Ronald Reagan, and judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals, a proud conservative. We're going to be discussing, you know, what is the difference between conservative and liberal? What does this really mean? And I think you're going to find it a very interesting conversation. However, for our first hour, as always, every Friday has been for 3 years or more on this program, Senator Bernie Sanders talking with you, the people, and me as well, our brunch with Bernie. Senator Sanders is neither a Democrat nor a Republican, an independent. I think of him as America's senator. So it's our brunch with Bernie segments. Bernie Sanders, good morning.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. Let me just remind our listeners that you'll be taking our calls, taking their calls at 866-303-2270, and people can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. Bernie, I'm looking at the front page of today's USA Today, and the lead headline, kids face cutbacks in health coverage, money running out in 14 states. What they're not including is that this is exactly what the conservatives have been campaigning for since Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981.
That's exactly right, and that is an incredible national disgrace. We are the only nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people. We have millions of children who have no health insurance, and unless Congress gets its act together immediately, and some of us are working hard on this right now, there will be even more people, more young people, more children without any health insurance at all. And this is literally beyond comprehension. You know, and when we talk about children, we should also understand that it's not just a health care crisis. Tom, we have by far the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth. And in some European countries, the rate is below 5%. We are, depending on the studies that you look at, over 18%.
Right.
These are kids who are growing up with enormous disadvantages, and in the long run, it is going to cost our society dearly in terms of human suffering. Just looking at the front page of the USA Today, if kids don't have health insurance today, if their parents are not taking them to the doctors, you know what? In the long run, it's going to cost you more. Diseases and illnesses that could have been detected now are not going to be treated, and then kids are going to get sicker and require much more expensive health care. I think everybody knows that. This is a disgrace. And in response to situations like this, not only the fact that children in this country don't have any health care, not only in terms of the fact that we're underfunding the needs of our veterans, or that we have people living out in the streets because we're not building affordable housing, or that we have middle-class families unable to send their kids to college, or that we have senior citizens who are not getting the nutrition that they need, and on it goes. What I have just introduced is legislation which tries to crystallize all of these realities in what we call a National Priorities Act. And it's a very simple proposal. It says, look at the needs facing America, childhood poverty, the high cost of college education, and the inability of middle-class families to send their kids to college, the needs of our veterans, and many other needs, and then say, can we afford to address those problems that impact the middle class and working families of our country? Can we afford to do that? And the answer is, of course we can. But to do that, we're going to have to raise revenue. Well, okay, how do you do that? Well, we propose to do that in two very simple ways. Number one, you rescind the tax breaks that have been given to the very wealthiest people in this country, the wealthiest 1%. One of the issues that is not talked about terribly much in the major media, in the corporate media, is the fact is that while poverty is increasing, while the middle class is shrinking, the people on top have not had it so good since the 1920s. The wealthiest people in this country, there was just a study that came out the other day, proliferation of billionaires. Those folks do not need more tax breaks. I don't know if you read about this, but Bill Gates came before the committee I'm on with Senator Kennedy, the Health, Education, yeah. Labor Committee. And I asked Gates, I said, Bill Gates' father has been very strong in saying we should not repeal the estate tax, which if we do, the 99.8% of American families would benefit not at all. The only beneficiaries would be the top 0.2%, including, of course, the Gates family. And Gates' father has been very strong in saying, no, we should not do that. That's wrong. And I asked Bill Gates, and he said, no, he agrees with his father. So you have people like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates saying, we are multi-billionaires. Our families do not need any more money. Do not repeal the estate tax, which cost us $1 trillion over a 10-year period, which gets us back to the front page of USA Today, which says kids face cutbacks in health coverage. So you have a president of the United States, a number of Republicans, virtually all of them saying, yeah, let's give Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and other billionaires huge tax breaks, even though they don't want it, they don't need it, but we can't afford to provide health insurance and health care for our kids. What an absurd set of priorities. The other area that we're looking at is that at a time when military spending is soaring, we believe that while we want to have a strong defense, we certainly want to be capable of fighting international terrorism, etc., it is clear to me that we have not taken a hard look at the Pentagon in the amount of waste, bureaucracy that is there, weapon systems that were geared to fight the Soviet Union that are not relevant in terms of the fight against Al-Qaeda. We can save some $60 billion there, plus $70 billion from the richest 1% by rescinding their tax breaks, $130 billion. Then you could begin to address the health care crisis in America, the education crisis, the environmental crisis, get us to begin to deal with global warming, investing in sustainable energy, in energy efficiency, putting people to work, building affordable housing, doing all the things that we need to do to strengthen the middle class. We can do it. And I've introduced this legislation just to show that it is not that complicated to do.
It really boils down to the name of your act, the National Priorities Act, because there really is a set of dueling priorities here. You've got conservatives who would look at today's headline in the USA Today and see that 13 states are cutting back on programs for the CHIPS programs, basically the childhood health programs, and say, great, government should not be in the business of providing health care. That's the conservative position. The government should not be in the business of providing Social Security. It shouldn't be backstopping the people. You got people who are working for so little wages that they can't even afford to have, you know, standard housing or buy a home or send their kids to school. Tough. That's the free market. And then you've got the average American, the mainstream American, saying, no, wait a minute, we're a compassionate society.
You're absolutely right. And you know what? There was a poll, I don't know if you saw it, front page New York Times, I think it was last week, overwhelming support. I don't have the numbers in front of me. Well over 70%, as I recall, of people saying, of course we should fund, all children in this country should have health insurance. People are prepared to pay more in taxes themselves, let alone ask the wealthiest people in this country to pay a little bit more. So in this issue, what's interesting here, Tom, is you have a Congress which is very clearly dominated by big money interests who are way out of touch with mainstream America. So if you go to any street corner in America, mainstream America, and you say, do you give tax breaks to billionaires and not provide funding for children's health care, not put money into energy efficiency and sustainable energy, not take care of our veterans, not put people to work building affordable housing, people say, what are you, crazy? No, yeah. Of course we shouldn't do that. And yet you have a significant number of people in the United States Congress, and of course the guy in the White House, who believes just that. Way out of touch.
Yeah, and these ideologues, if you look at the history, at the 230-some-odd-year history of the United States, every time that their policies have been ascendant, you know, the 1920s, for example, the era of the robber barons, really, from 1880 to 1920s, with the exception of when Teddy Roosevelt was president, every time their policies have been ascendant, what have we had? We've had an explosion of poverty, increase in social unrest, more warlike behavior in the United States, and the rich have gotten a whole lot richer.
Right. Look, these guys use ideology. You know, if I have a whole lot of money, and I want to have more money, and I want to take away your rights, and I want to have you work for $3 an hour, I hire somebody to give me the ideology which matches that reality. The real issue here is human greed. That's what it is. And you have at the top of American society today, not all, But many of these guys whose ideology, whose religion is greed, they could care less about anybody else, and then they develop a mythology to go with that greed.
Right, a mythology that has never been demonstrated to work.
Right.
It's Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie will be taking your calls right after this break, 303-202-3. Well, I'll have to get back with you on the phone number. Anyhow, you know the number. We'll be right back, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You're listening to Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
For the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. We're broadcasting live today from the studios of KTalk in Los Angeles, AM 1150. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our number, 866-303-2270. That's a relatively new number for us. Anyhow, welcome back to the program. Let's see here. Dave in Los Angeles. We'll start with an L.A. call. Hey, Dave, you're live with Bernie Sanders. Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. An honor to speak to two great Americans. I've got a lot to say in this. I'll try to make it quick. But, Bernie, I watched C-SPAN with the conference with Bill Gates this week with you there. And, frankly, I was disgusted to see Bill Gates there. Here's a college dropout who built his company mainly almost by stealing his code, the MS-DOS code. But he's an exploiter of the technologists. And I was sitting there going, where's Dean Kamen? Dean Kamen, with his first program, which is the for inspiration recognition of science and technology, is doing more privately than Bill Gates ever had. Bill Gates just wants grist for the mill. And then the other thing is you need to look at the career opportunities after. Everybody assumes you get an engineering degree, you get a technology degree, you've got a long, stable, good-paying job. That's the furthest thing from the truth. It's almost migrant workers nowadays going from one company to the other. There's, you know, you're not going to get the kids to go out there.
Well, I think, Dave, you make a good point. And one of the real concerns that I have, where I think Bill Gates is very wrong, Gates is very much of a free trader. And I think that not only have we lost millions of good-paying blue-collar manufacturing jobs, we have already and are about to lose millions more white-collar information technology jobs. Because many of these corporations are going to India, going to China, going to Russia, where they can get labor at far lower costs. So this, I think, is a huge issue, and I think it's an issue we've got to address.
Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Hello to both of you. Are members of the Senate, particularly the freshman senators, are they ready to step up to their constitutional duty to tell President gone wild, no on fast-track authority for trade, or are they going to continue to be atrophied and submissive to this wannabe king, and will they fall for the acknowledgement by somebody like Bernanke? I heard him on NPR about a month ago saying that, yes, inequality in income is bad, but he's also afraid that Americans want to stop so-called free trade. So I guess he thinks more of the same is the solution.
Yeah, it's going to take 40 votes to stop Fast Track, isn't it, Bernie?
Yeah, I think we have a very good chance to stop Fast Track. I think we have a good chance to begin to reform trade policy in this country. I can't speak for any other member of the Senate, but I am a person who in the House of Representatives introduced legislation to repeal permanent normal trade relations with China, voted against NAFTA, voted against CAFTA. I think that if we want to understand why the middle class is shrinking, why we're losing good-paying jobs, you got to look at what's happening to globalization and its impact on the American middle class. Bottom line is that corporate America has used unfettered free trade to throw Americans out on the street and move abroad. I'm worried about what happens with white-collar jobs. So I can't speak for anybody else, but I do know that a number of the people who were elected with me campaigned against unfettered free trade, and I know they're going to stand up and demand a change in policy.
That's great. Len in New York City, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, it's an honor. As I'm talking to you, I'm doing tax returns. I'm an accountant in New York. And my recommendation is on how to talk to people about tax rate changes and more talking about their taxable income rather than the percentage that they're in. And I'm suggesting that you look, you know, given the distance it's been since the last tax rate changes, of creating separate tax brackets for as high as 1.2 million and above, and then like 750 and 300,000. So you could promise anybody, because if you're making $300,000 in New York, you're not doing so great, even though, of course, it's doing very well. But if you got your kids in a private school, there are different realities, obviously, with all the different, with the alternative minimum tax and everything.
Right.
But the objective here is to create, you know, stratified, you know, positions where people can see at least if they're making under $300,000, they're not going to have their taxes increase.
Well, that's a good point. And I think certainly what you're really saying is an argument and an effort to fight against Republicans who talk in broad terms, oh, they're raising taxes, when in fact what some of us are talking about is no. The proposals that I'm fighting for, in fact, would lower taxes for the middle class while raising it for the very wealthiest people in our society. What Len is saying is that it's important that we talk about clear income so that people know whose side we are on.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our entire first hour, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls at 866-303-2270 here on the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us, broadcasting live today from the studios of K-Talk AM 1150 in Los Angeles. We'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
You touched my heart.
And now it's time for us to save this country. We got a bunch of right-wing cranks who have taken over and really run this thing into the ground, and there is so much that needs to be done. Senator Bernie Sanders, one of the leaders of that movement, the founder of the Progressive Caucus, our Brunch with Bernie segment, right now, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Pam in San Diego, California, you are live with Bernie Sanders. Hey, Pam.
As a senator, I have a question, and then at the end, I have a means that people can help address situation. Senator, what do you think about announced plans to upgrade our nuclear weapons arsenal?
What do I think about putting more money into nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
I disagree with that very strongly. In fact, I think clearly the goal of the United States and the rest of the international community should be to ban nuclear weapons from this planet.
In fact, we did sign a treaty to that effect about 25 years ago, as I recall. We haven't had much success with it. Jerry in Long Island, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. Yes, Senator, against the backdrop of the Libby guilty verdicts, will Congress subpoena Vice President Cheney to testify under oath about his role in outing Valerie Plame as a Central Intelligence Agency operative? And should Cheney resign from office over his involvement in the leak of Valerie Plame's ID? And also, with respect to the phony Niger documents, will anyone be subpoenaed to testify under oath about those phony forged Niger documents, which falsely claimed to show that Saddam Hussein was seeking to obtain uranium from Niger?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I'm not on the Armed Forces Committee or the committees that would be doing that. But what is the good news is that for the first time in 6 years, subpoenas are now being used. And members of the administration are now being forced to come forward to start answer some very hard questions. There are questions now that we're going to be asking, Congress will be asking about how we got into this war in the first place, how it ended up that with our troops not getting the equipment that they need, that Halliburton ends up making huge amounts of profit. So I can't answer your question. I just don't know it. But there are investigations going on now that are long overdue.
Yeah, it's hopeful. It's looking good. Barry in Southfield, Michigan, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for Mr. Sanders. This is in regard to the unemployment reports that are given monthly. They all state new claims. There's no idea how many old claims are out there. And I'm referring this back to Bush's gloating of 300,000 jobs being created in August of 2003. And if you remember, in July of 2003, the House and the Senate met to extend, requesting extension of the unemployment benefits. And a month later, Bush says that there's 300,000 jobs that were created after that was rescinded. Is there any way we can have oversight look into that? And also, why can't we have anything done about the gas prices? We need to bring those people back to the table and put them under oath.
Okay, you've asked two good questions. In terms of gas prices, I think everybody knows that you have an oil industry, ExxonMobil and the others, that are making record-breaking profits. You have the former CEO of ExxonMobil, a guy named Lee Raymond, I think, who was given a retirement, got a nice little retirement package when he left the company of, what was it, Tom, $400
million? $400 million, yeah.
Not a bad retirement
package. Yeah, not too shabby.
In this day and age. And you have fewer and fewer large corporations within the oil industry that have tremendous power. You have OPEC, which can control, heavily influenced by the oil industry, which can control the production of oil. When prices go too low, they cut back on what they're producing. And I always have found that strange and introduced legislation to address that issue, that with some of our friends in the White House and Congress, such strong believers in unfettered free trade, that how they have never challenged the existence of an oil cartel whose very existence is designed to limit the production of oil.
Yeah.
But they have forgotten to challenge that for some strange reason. But I think the caller is quite right. The time is long overdue to get these guys up under oath to find out what goes on in the oil industry so that working people are forced to pay outrageously high prices when their wages are stagnant at the same time as oil profits are soaring. I'm sorry, Tom, the other question?
That was the two of them. Although I'd toss in, you know, let's also start moving toward more fuel-efficient cars and,
absolutely.
And alternative energy sources.
Now, Detroit has been a disaster in that regard, and the Japanese are cleaning their clocks by producing more energy-efficient cars. There was just a hearing here the other day, by the way, by a company called Tesla Electric Cars. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yeah.
And they are now selling in the United States an electric car that I believe has or will have or will soon be for sale, a 250-mile range.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. It really is.
And I think they're going to get the prices down on that. I think there's a lot of potential there. Raising the CAFE standards is something clearly that we forgot to do. And producing cars and hybrids and electric cars that will protect the environment and be good investments for consumers.
Yep. Vicki in Idaho Falls, Idaho, listening on KPHX. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders.
And hi, Vicki.
I was wondering if you knew how much money the U.S. government has lost in tax revenues due to outsourcing. And the reason why I'm asking that is because in 2005 there was an article in the New York Times that Congress had to make a deal with the corporations for a 5.25% tax rate in order to get them to repatriate their profits back into this country to pay taxes on them.
Vicki, that is an excellent point. And I don't have all of the details in front of me, but your point is absolutely right. We are losing billions of dollars in tax revenue because a lot of these companies are running to the Cayman Islands, they're running to the Bahamas. In fact, it was funny. I saw a picture. There was a hearing, and there was a photograph of a building in, I believe, the Cayman Islands, which housed hundreds of American companies. It was a totally phony operation where they had a post office box in the building. See, I have these corporations that are running abroad to avoid paying their taxes. I've introduced legislation to address that, and we're certainly going to fight to address that issue. It is just absolutely unacceptable when middle-class people are paying taxes at a rate that many of them can't afford, that you have these corporations running abroad.
Yesterday we did a segment on all these furniture companies out in West Virginia that are shutting down because their production is going to China. And all of those, what were good-paying union jobs, were those folks were paying income taxes. And those income taxes aren't going to be paid anymore.
No, that's absolutely right. So, yeah. It's obviously as workers lose good-paying jobs and get lower-paying jobs, there's less tax revenue.
Yeah. John in Seattle, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders. John?
Hello?
Hey, you're live and on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Bernie and Tom. This is really wonderful what you're doing. I just had a question about Social Security disability applications. I'm now 1 year into the process, and I've been through three phases of rejections. And I don't know if you have any kind of expertise in this area, but I would really like some suggestions.
Well, John, let me suggest this to you. We have outstanding caseworkers in the state of Vermont, and anybody who calls up our toll-free number will get help on issues like this. Why don't you give your senators or your congressperson a ring? They often have staff there that are very good and can fight the bureaucracy to make sure you get what you're entitled to. So you got Patty Murray and you got Maria Cantwell in the Senate and don't know who your congressperson is. I would give them a ring. You'd be surprised. They have some good staff there who could help you.
Especially the House of Representatives, it seems like for a really quick response. Although a lot of senators are really good at it, too. I know you are. John in Amherst, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, John.
Congratulations on winning the Senate race, and keep up the good work. I'm concerned with the recent story that came out about the Inspector General of the Pentagon saying that intelligence had been falsified regarding the connection of Al-Qaeda with 9/11 and whether some committee should look into this.
I think you are going to have committees looking into just that issue. As you know, one of the reasons that the Bush told us we had to go to Warren Cheney was especially big on this, is there was somehow a connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. The truth is their ideologies are radically different. There was no connection, and there was a lot of cherry-picking of evidence, and I believe that there will be a hearing on that. There absolutely should be.
Scott in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. We have about a half a minute before we got to take a break, Scott. You're live with Bernie. Scott?
Yes. Oh, hi.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a quick comment. I heard the senator, mention that a lot of senators, especially Republicans, are out of touch. And I think we're just a little too polite a lot of times when we're talking about the other side. I think the truth is that they just really don't care. They don't give a damn. And I think we need to be a little bit stronger in our message when we're trying to get it out.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
Scott, thanks a lot for the call and the comment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here, as it always is. The first hour of every Friday has been for 3 years, and hopefully will be for at least three more. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, Brunch with Bernie. We'll be right back, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Where the grass and the dirt and the gravel on me. Going back to the well, going to visit old friends and feed my soul. We're the Black Tongue.
And I've just lost my audio coming back, so if you guys can hear me, you might want to. I think you just lost your mix minus. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, on the assumption that we are still on the air. Although I'm still, we're on. Okay, I'm hearing nothing. You got to feed me back. Okay, let's go. Let's see. Dan in San Diego, California. Dan. Hey, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I had a question for the senator, and You talked about OPEC, but OPEC is largely not under our control. What about the things we can control, such as giving tax breaks to the oil companies as they're making record profits and they're getting oil from public lands without paying royalties, things like that? So.
No, you're absolutely right, Dan, but I would disagree with you. I think the oil companies do have impact on OPEC as well, and that's a very important part of the process. But clearly at a time when the oil companies are making record-breaking profits, you don't give them billions of dollars in corporate welfare, or you don't allow them to drill on public lands and make all kinds of money without paying a fair royalty. And I think the House has begun to move in that direction, and I think the Senate will do as well.
Great. Chris in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hello, Senator. My question is about the, I don't know what you want to call it, purge and mass firing of the 8 U.S. attorneys.
Yep.
Back in December. The Judiciary Committee over the Senate is in the process of authorizing subpoenas for many justice officials, including, among others, Kyle Sampson, who's chief of staff to Alberto Gonzalez, and that'll be interesting to watch. Pete Domenici, the senator from our state, has hired counsel in the form of a man named Blaylock, who used to counsel Randy Duke Cunningham when he was being prosecuted by a woman named Carol Lamb in San Diego, who was also one of the attorneys who was fired back in December. My basic question is, what does the senator think was behind this? Was it mere political cronyism, or was there something more sinister? Because I can't really seem to find a reason for this having happened.
Well, what we do know, that's a good question, and that's why they're doing these hearings, to get some answers, but it smells pretty bad. In an almost unprecedented way, you have the recall, the forced resignation of 7 or 8 U.S. attorneys in an area where we want absolutely as little political influence as possible. They have a very difficult jobs to do, and you don't want political influence. We know that Rove, at least one replacement, was somebody that Rove recommended. And there is some argument on the part of some of these U.S. attorneys who lost their jobs that they think it is political. Now, we know that a couple of Republicans made telephone calls. So if it is political, you got another outrage in terms of the Bush administration interfering with our judicial and prosecutorial system. But there are hearings taking place both in the House and the Senate. They're going to tell us more about this.
Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. I want to tell you, Bernie, genuinely, you know, out of the miasma and stench of lies and corruption that emanates from Washington seemingly on a daily basis, your words and actions really are encouraging and give people like me hope. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Charlie.
Every day seems to bring another revelation of scandal, the Walter Reed, the purging of the DAs. Even today, the secret trials, the star chamber at Gitmo, and the FBI's abuse of the Patriot Act, those national security letters that they underreported. But specifically, it seems to me one of the foundations of possibly changing things would be public financing of elections. We see this burgeoning monopoly in satellite radio, and I heard a network executive this week say that they would be against public financing of elections because they would lose ad revenue. So beyond the wrong-headed Buckley versus Vallejo decision, don't these airways belong to us?
Well, you know what, Jolly? In about a half hour, the head of the FCC is going to be in my office. And that is exactly what we are going to be, what Mr. Martin and I are going to be talking about. To my mind, the airwaves do belong to the people. I think especially under Reagan, the obligations that stations had to serve the public interest and not just make money was enormously diminished. Recently, there was an instance, in fact, where something good happened from the FCC, which is very rare indeed, and that, as you may recall, they fined Univision because they're obligated to provide 3 hours a week of programming for children, educational program for kids, and they really didn't, and we're going to talk about that. But to answer Charlie's question, we are working on very strong legislation that brings back the public interest to the airwaves and demands that stations that get licenses that those licenses are more than licenses to make money, that they have a responsibility to the public.
And
but Charlie's point is very, very important.
And Charlie's suggestion of public financing?
Absolutely. No, that's I believe in that strongly. We have a Congress, when people want to know why we give tax breaks to billionaires and can't fund children's health care or the needs of our veterans, it really comes down to who has the power, who is financing elections. And that is the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations. And clearly public financing, which is working very well in states like Maine, Arizona, is a step forward, and that's something that the Congress has got to adopt.
Brian in Boulder, Colorado. We have about a half a minute, Brian.
Thank you, and keep up the good work to both of you guys. Senator, we are killing people and really spending lots of money in Iraq. What can people like me do?
Keep the pressure up. The momentum is with us. More and more members of the Congress, including an increasing number of Republicans, understand that this war is a disaster, that we've got to bring our troops home as soon as possible, and that not only are we spending huge sums of money losing lives for our own people, for the Iraqis, but that we have lost our eye, our focus on international terrorism, Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Keep up the pressure.
Bernie, what's more effective, writing a letter to your member of Congress or your senator or calling their office?
Do them both. They all have 800 numbers, and they all read the letters.
Great. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, it's always so great having you on. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Talk to you next week. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with the news of the day and your calls right after this. Tom Hartman with you.
Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Los Angeles from the studios of K-Talk, AM 1150 in L.A. Having a fine old time today, and boy, there's a lot in the news. George W. Bush down in Brazil, and what a contrast. The folks over at the thinkprogress.org blog pointing this out, by the way, to give credit where credit is due. What a contrast. This from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Company, today. Clashes broke out in Brazil's largest city as U.S. President Bush arrived at the start of a six-day regional tour. At least 20 people were injured in clashes with riot police in Sao Paulo after thousands turned out to protest against George W. Bush's visit. In Sao Paulo, about 10,000 people spilled out along one of the city's broadest avenues in the heart of the financial district, banging drums, waving red flags, and carrying banners reading, "Bush, go home!" Many of the demonstrators are angry at the war in Iraq and the proposed ethanol deal, which they say is an attempt to control the country's production of the biofuel, which powers 8 out of 10 vehicles. So we've got that. Guatemala City. Mayan priests are going to purify a sacred archaeological site to eliminate bad spirits after President Bush visits. An official with close ties to the group said this in the Boston Globe. That a person like Bush, says Juan Tinney, the director of the Mayan non-governmental organization with close ties to the Mayan religious and political leaders. He says that a person like Bush, with the persecution of our migrant brothers in the United States, with the wars he has provoked, is going to walk in our sacred lands is an offense for the Mayan people and our culture. He said the spirit guides of the Mayan community decided it would be necessary to cleanse the sacred site of bad spirits after Bush's visit so that their ancestors could rest in peace. I mean, so that's where we're at right now in the world, right? Our president, the president of the United States, our president goes someplace, and the local people feel that they have to do purification rituals. And people are showing up in the street saying, no, we, you know. Well, let's step into the Wayback Machine here and go way back 10 years ago to 1997. 9.5 years ago, October 15th, 1997, from the Christian Science Monitor. Bill Clinton is our president. He goes down to Rio and actually, essentially, blows off his Secret Service detail to hang out with the peoples. Well, here's what the Christian Science Monitor wrote. It was his trip to a Xerox-sponsored sports center in the Rio slum of Mangueira that won the hearts of many, if I think I'm pronouncing it, that won the hearts of many Brazilians and caused a TV commentator to tell his viewers that Clinton's speech had him on the verge of tears. Clinton ignored the Secret Service's rigid security by shaking hands and allowing admirers to hug and kiss him. Here he is. He's walking into the crowds. There's a photo here of him standing there with thousands of people all around him. Back to the Christian Science Monitor piece. Some people ran up and gave him shirts and caps emblazoned with the logo of the slums carnival group. Jamelo, one of Mangueira's most famous samba personalities, said, "Bill Clinton looked like a happy kid, finally let loose on the streets." Clinton waved a Brazilian flag, listened to samba music while hitting a tambourine, and kicked a soccer ball with Brazil Sports Minister Edson Arantes de Niscamineto, the legendary ex-player known as Pelé. So, you know, here, and you look at the pictures of the protest in Sao Paulo, and you have pictures of Bush with a Hitler mustache and with a Nazi flag, and we have become pariahs around the world as a consequence of the behavior of the man leading this country. And it's not, and this is not about, gee, let's pick on George W. Bush. It's about an entire structural philosophy, this entire neocon notion that the only way to be safe and the only way to be secure is to have absolute power. And there really is a profound difference in a fundamental difference in these two worldviews. Historically, and literally going back to George Washington's farewell address where he warned us against foreign entanglements. Literally from the founding of this country, the basic premise that we have believed and understood and by and large, yeah, we've blown it a few times, but by and large operated out of, and that is true also for the vast majority of all the other democracies in the world, and even many of the countries in the world that are not democracies, is that safety and security as a nation comes about as a consequence of being a participant in a community of nations and being a reasonably good neighbor, of being a non-belligerent. It gets back to this notion, that liberal notion that this country was founded on, that it's all about community, that we're all in this together, that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, that if any among us, now we're talking now at the level of nations, if any among us are in crisis, then all of us should consider ourselves to be in crisis and do something about it, something positive, something helpful, something useful, something that elevates people. But there's also another way of looking at the world. And even though that's the way that we have looked at the world through most of the history of the United States, we have had a couple of presidents, and, well, let me back up on that. I'm not even sure I can say that we've had a couple of presidents. We've certainly had a lot of people, you know, Joe McCarthy, classic example. We've certainly had a lot of politicians who believe, and it may well be that George Bush is our first president who actually believes this, who believe in a philosophy that is often referred to as kind of the neocon philosophy or some variation of that, that the way to safety and security is to have your hand around everybody else's throat, is to have absolute power, is to be so powerful and so frightening that nobody will dare challenge you. And, you know, it's an appealing worldview, is an appealing philosophy for those people who feel the most powerless. And it is a characteristic philosophy of people who have grown up feeling terribly powerless. I mean, you find, you know, if, for example, men who beat their wives tend to be deep down inside the most insecure and terrified people out there. The people who will stalk across the country to kill somebody, well, as we just saw with this astronaut, I mean, it's not limited just to men, obviously, although it's more frequent with men. But people who will kill somebody that they are supposedly in love with because that person's going to leave them. I mean, this is all a variation of the same mentality that we're seeing played out in the Bush administration. That the only way that we can be safe and secure, and you're seeing played out, by the way, across the conservative media, among many of the right-wing talk show hosts, because they share this worldview, and I suspect they probably share similar upbringings. They have this belief that we are not a nation of barn builders, that we are not a nation in community with other nations, that the United Nations is a bad idea, that even talking to other nations, particularly if we don't like them, is a bad idea, that we just need to be so incredibly dangerous, so totally, you know, don't mess with me, that everybody will leave us alone. And the fact of the matter is that typically when you take that position, I mean, it might work in the schoolyard, you know, where you got 20 or 30 kids and you actually are the biggest and toughest kid. But over time, even that's not going to work. And it certainly doesn't work in the context of a group of nations. It will over a short period of time. Yeah, Rome was an empire for a while. The British were an empire for a while. The Nazis were an empire for a while. They controlled most of Europe for a while. But it doesn't hold. Because eventually people say, no, wait a minute. We want freedom. We want community. We want peace. We want stability. We want a certain level of equality. We want to be part of the community of nations. We want to be a part of the community of peoples. And they reject it. And that's what's happening right now. George Bush is down in Brazil. And again, as I said, this is not like gratuitously bashing Bush. This is a genuine crisis in this country right now that has to do with this foundational, what is called conservative worldview. And frankly, I would say it is a worldview that was not shared by the classic conservatives in America, or at least the recent ones like Barry Goldwater and Everett Dirksen. And Dwight Eisenhower is going to say, really, you could say Eisenhower was a liberal. But nonetheless, this is the new kind of conservatism, thus neo. And it is not only harming the world, and it's not only led to the death of hundreds of thousands of people, it's harming our nation as well. And it's another one of the reasons why it's so important that all of us get out there and get active, get politically active, join organizations, show up for Democracy for America meetings, show up at your local Democratic Party, Republican Party, Green Party, Progressive Party, whatever it may be, Constitution Party, I don't care, get involved. We've got to take this country back, my friend. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You're listening to Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
Price for freedom and a price for truth, and money doesn't bleed red, white, and blue.
Indeed, my friends, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy right here in the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. A lot of media outlets, Salon.com, actually, a great piece Glenn Greenwald did. He starts out talking about media. Multiple media outlets are focusing on the unsurprising story that the FBI seems to have been abusing its powers under the Patriot Act. See, this is another variation on this theory that if you clamp down, if you put your foot on people's heads, if you can just throw enough people in prison, if you can just kill enough people, then everything will be fine. You know, George W. Bush, he executed more people as governor of Texas than any other governor in the history of the United States, period, and is proud of it, and bragged about the fact that he never spent more than 20 minutes reviewing a clemency request. Why? Because, well, if you can kill as many bad people as possible, eventually there won't be any more bad people. That's the worldview of these guys. And the reality is that when you kill people, typically they have brothers and sisters and cousins and uncles and nephews and aunts and whatnot who say, wait a minute, I'm not real happy with that. Now, maybe, you know, with the death penalty, somebody commits a heinous crime, their relatives aren't so upset, but if you kill 600,000 people in Iraq, the vast majority of them innocent civilians, they do have relatives who are going to be upset. And, you know, you have to deal with the fallout from that. Tragically, our soldiers are dealing with it. But back to the point here, this worldview of hyper control, which comes out of a fundamental and frankly pathological, psychopathological insecurity, has now contaminated the FBI domestically. Congress passed a law, the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, that says that the FBI actually has a relatively expanded police powers. However, when the executive branch, that's the president, decides to order the FBI or authorize the FBI to use those through the Justice Department, through Alberto Gonzalez, he has to notify Congress. So there is some check and balance to the power that the executive branch has, because basically the legislative branch has no police powers. The House and the Senate, the second branch of government, or the first branch of government, rather, the legislative branch, Article 1 of the Constitution creates the House and the Senate. They do not, they actually do have their own police force. It's the House and Senate police. But they only have any authority to do anything on the floor of the House and Senate and in the immediate offices. In other words, they can only police themselves. So everywhere else in the country, the police powers are delegated to the executive branch, which operates under the president. However, those police powers are defined, actually handed to the executive branch by Congress and limited by Congress. And Congress says, this is how much police power you can have, and this is how much you can't have. So when they reauthorized the Patriot Act, which increased the police powers that the FBI had, they said, however, you've got to let us know if you're going to use this stuff. And back in March of 2006, as Glenn Greenwald points out in Salon.com today, the Boston Globe's Charlie Savage wrote a piece. What Glenn Greenwald, and I agree with him, calls a typically superb article from Charlie Savage. Here it is, March 2006. Now, we're a year ago, almost exactly a year ago. When President Bush signed the reauthorization of the U.S. Patriot Act this month, he included an addendum. This is a signing statement, saying that he did not feel obligated to obey requirements that he inform Congress about how the FBI was using the Act's expanded police power. In the signing statement, Bush said that he did not consider himself bound to tell Congress how the Patriot Act powers were being used, and that despite the law's requirements, he could withhold the information if he decided that disclosure would, quote, impair foreign relations, national security, the deliberative process of the executive, or the performance of the executive's constitutional duties. In other words, he could say, well, you know, because I need to think about this some more, I don't need to tell Congress. That would impair the deliberative process of the executive. Do you get this? This is King George. This is not America. I mean, this is not consistent with the values of America. And now we're discovering that, sure enough, these national security letters, which basically get around court orders, the Fourth Amendment says very, very clearly, you cannot search somebody's home, you cannot go through their papers, you cannot go through their personal effects, unless somebody offers sworn testimony and a judge decides that there is probable cause that a crime is being committed, and then it can be investigated. And Bush has just blown this out of the water. Again, this is this massive insecurity that has gripped this administration. And I think it is personalities drawing personalities. It's those kinds of people drawing those kinds of people into the government and placing them in places like federal judgeships and prosecutors' roles. We'll take your calls right after this. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest or corporate global, whatever it may be. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Blog over at AirAmericaRadio.com. I have the live chat room up right now. And Dennis in Cedar Crest, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Dennis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mr. Hartman. I'm a first-time caller, and I want to first of all thank you for all that you do. I miss Al Franken, but your show is fabulous, frankly.
Well, thank you, Dennis, and please call me Tom. Let's not start a precedent here.
Okay. Listen, I don't get to listen regularly, but about 3 weeks ago you had a conversation with a man. I think it was Monday, March the 19th. I assume that he was a psychiatrist and a writer, but your topic was the magnitude of the mistake. And you talked about the emotional impact that people were going to have, and you talked about the Japanese people and the German people after World War II,
right?
And how they had felt betrayed, and they were
right. How they were basically deprogrammed. They had bought into a cult. Yeah.
Right. What was the term that you used? You used some words that I had not heard before. They were fabulous words, but I can't bring them up.
I'm not sure. I mean, this is my own personal theory. I haven't. There was a fair amount of writing actually about it in the 1950s, where people were trying to figure out what was the source of fascism. How could the fascist personality emerge? You know, and then that led to like the Milgram studies and things like that. But you know, my theory of it, and some of this, frankly, based on stories my dad told me when he was part of the Japanese occupation forces. You know, he was the U.S. He joined the military. He was in boot camp when World War II ended, and so right after, you know, he got out of basic training, he got shipped over to Japan to be part of the occupation forces, and he spent 2 years there. And just the idea that the Japanese and the Germans, and I lived in Germany for a year and met a lot of Germans who remember the Hitler times, and that in both cases what had happened was essentially a cult had taken over their government that was every bit as toxic and every bit as messianic as the Jim Jones cult, and essentially a very self-destructive, a very insecure, a profoundly pathological cult. And you know, and at its core, a cult of personality. That's why I say messianic cult. The Germans, many Germans that I talked with said, you know, back then they actually believed that Hitler was the guy who was going to bring 1,000 years of peace to the world.
Right.
And maybe even was ordained by God to lead the German people. At least in the early 30s, they were thinking that. And the same thing in Japan. I mean, you had people who were willing to fly, volunteering to fly kamikaze planes into the decks of U.S. aircraft carriers. I mean, you know, suicide attacks are nothing new. And so what happened after the war, when the Japanese saw the horrors of the rape of Nanking and everything else, you know, that they had done, and when the Germans saw the horrors of the concentration camps, and the public woke up. I mean, there was just this massive deprogramming, and that's why not a single soldier, not a single American soldier was lost in hostile fire during the occupation of Germany after World War II or the occupation of Japan. I mean, my dad said that they literally were welcomed with flowers, and when they came into Japan, I mean, he was with the original forces that went in there, and it was completely different from Iraq, because the Iraqis were not part of, you know, they were not cult followers. In fact, if anything, they, by and large, the average Iraqi at a certain level opposed Saddam Hussein. They wanted more democracy. I mean, they appreciated the fact that he, unlike many of the countries in the Middle East, allowed women to work, to go to school. They didn't have to cover their arms and their heads and all this nonsense. I shouldn't call it nonsense. That's culturally insensitive. And frankly, I digress. In any case, Saddam Hussein, you know, there were some parts of Iraq and Iraqi culture that they were very, very proud of, and they were not cult followers fundamentally. And so when we show up and we say, okay, we got rid of Saddam for you, they're like, yes, so, you know, we want electricity. We'd like some water. And we say, well, you're not going to get electricity or water. We're busy building bases and drilling oil wells. And they get progressively more and more pissed off at us. And people wonder, you know, why is it that after World War II, the Germans welcomed us, and after the successful Iraq war, I mean, it only lasted a few weeks, basically, then the occupation began, and the occupation failed. And it's because it wasn't a cult that we took down. Bush lied to us about what Saddam Hussein was up to and the whole administration. And frankly, even if he had been up to much of it, I don't think that the Iraqi people would have would have said, hey, wait a minute, get rid of him. Now, there was a moment, actually, back, you know, during the Iraq-Iran war and during Saddam's invasion of Kuwait, when there was strong sentiment in Iraq of, we don't want any more war. I mean, they had lost 1 million of their kids in the Iraq-Iran war, where I think it would have been possible to take out Saddam Hussein. And there was probably, one of those gestalt-shifting moments. But it certainly isn't now. It certainly wasn't after 8-9 years of sanctions, which the Iraqi people viewed as just continuous punishment by the United States. So, you know, that was my point. Dennis, I got to move along, but thanks for opening up the rant for me there. Phil at Sherman Oaks, again, thanks for listening. Phil in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hi, how you doing? You had mentioned before about schoolyard bullies, and
yeah.
You weren't sure if the same rules apply to this international belligerent bully concept.
No, I think they do, actually.
Yeah, I really do. Because
over the short term it seems to work, and over the long term it doesn't.
Yeah, sooner or later all the little kids are going to team up, and they're going to take the guy down. But if you're the biggest, baddest guy in the schoolyard, and you protect everyone, and you take care of people, and you don't act out of turn, and you don't abuse your power, people leave you alone. But on the other hand, if you just go around pushing people down for no reason, and they're going to take you down.
Well, and this is the thing that Bush misses, is that even the gangs, I mean, there's a reason why you've got kids joining the Crips and the Bloods and whatnot, because they're not only being the baddest guys in town and providing some security through power, but they're also providing a certain sense of community and of safety. And if you look at a lot of governments around the world that we may not agree with and we may not like, nonetheless, what they're doing is they're providing for their people. I mean, it's just a government that doesn't provide for the needs of its people over time is going to disintegrate. It's just going to fall apart.
Let me ask you this. There's a sense of helplessness in the general community that we're stuck with these guys for another 2 years. The impeachment process is too lengthy, and we can't take them down anyway. There's not enough political will. There's a thousand reasons I hear why we can't do it. I don't view George Bush as a good man or a great man, but I don't view him as a horribly dangerous man, because I don't think he's intellectually capable of thinking things up like signing statements and invasions, etc.
Sam Alito actually came up with signing statements back during the Reagan administration.
Absolutely. I believe that what we're dealing with here is like an easily influenced kid who will get himself in trouble if he's surrounded by the wrong element. And what you do in that case is you kind of take him away from his bad friends, and you get him with a whole new pack of people. And I think that if we strenuously pursue taking down Cheney and maybe a couple other people around him, I think this whole world will turn into a different place, and that's where we should be focusing.
That's a good point, and I don't disagree. I would say also that we should expand our actions and look at the entirety of the so-called conservative movement today. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah. Phil, thanks for the call. For example, right now, where'd it go here? Here we go. The House conservatives appoint chief climate skeptic to lead new global warming panel. That's the headline over at thinkprogress.org. House representatives voted yesterday to create a new congressional committee that's going to look into global warming, right, the climate crisis. And so what do? In the House of Representatives, they get Sensenbrenner, who is one of these climate skeptics. He's one of these guys who, it's a grand conspiracy. He's the Inhofe of the House of Representatives. Back in 1998, when Clinton wanted to sign the Kyoto Protocols, he led a delegation of skeptics to the Kyoto Conference to fight against that. So here you have Sensenbrenner, endorsed by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, by the way. The people that regularly come on this program and argue with me, say, there's no such thing as global warming, as exceptionally well qualified and a good choice. Him and Dana Rohrabacher, who last month said that global warming was caused by dinosaur flatulence. I mean, get it. These are the guys that they want to put in charge of this thing. So we still have this Republican chorus, this support group, destructive support group, frankly, that is out there and that has a lot of power in the House of Representatives. And you say, you know, people feel powerless. The reason people feel powerless is because they have not yet translated their emotions into action. And that's my absolute clarion call all the time, is if you're feeling powerless, if you're feeling angry, if you're feeling upset, if you, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, some negative emotion that comes out of the behavior of this government, translate that into action. The action can be calling your member of the House of Representatives and your two senators. The action can be showing up at party meetings. The action can be showing, you know, joining a group that's nonpartisan, like a Democracy for America. I mean, there's so many things that can be done. Writing letters to the editor of the newspaper, calling into talk radio. Robert in San Francisco, just about a half a minute before we've got to take a break here, Robert. What's up?
Okay. Yeah, Tom, the 9/11 investigation that the King Commission had, we were promised by the Bush administration a full-scale investigation of 9/11. And
we never got it.
No, we got baited and switched there, and it was controlled right out of the White House. Zelikow prevented the commission from investigating U.S. Air Force training exercises that Cheney was involved in, involving lie-flight hijackings of commercial airliners and planes crashing into buildings. Then right after 9/11, he disappears into a secure, non-disclosed location, and controlled demolition is never a factor in the investigation, even though first responders came to their superiors and said, we've got evidence of bombs in the building.
Yeah, and then they gather up all the material and ship it off to China to have it recycled. Now, Robert, I agree with you, and I think that we need to have a real investigation of this. There needs to be a real, serious investigation of what happened on 9/11, and there hasn't been. And frankly, I think that there needs to be more than a real, serious. There needs to be many of them. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
To get away. Some days you gotta dance and live it up when you get the chance. Cause when the world doesn't make no sense and you're feeling just a little too tense, gotta loosen up those chains and dance.
There you go, my friends. Loosen up those chains and dance. Dance for a democracy. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. Your telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Victoria Jones on the line with us from Washington, D.C. with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria. Good morning.
Well, hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, wherever they are.
Yeah. Well, I'm in Los Angeles today, so I'm out of town, too.
Oh, it's morning for you, then.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in fact, broadcasting from KTalk, the new mainstream here in L.A. So what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it depends where you want to start. I mean, my goodness me.
Oh, you've got a whole bunch for us, huh?
Well, I mean, in terms of congressional hearings, next Friday we've got the very exciting Valerie Plame hearing, the glamour hearing.
Oh.
Where all the talk will be about what is she wearing rather than what is she going to say.
Which committee is that going to be?
That is Henry Waxman's committee.
So this is the House...
Government Oversight.
Government Oversight, okay. So that's, Henry Waxman is not a guy that you want to have his teeth attached to your pant leg.
No, you don't. You don't want him overseeing you.
Yeah, so that's got to be a hearing that, there's going to be a lot of discussion about what Valerie's wearing, but that's a hearing that really has the potential to make Mr. Rove and Mr. Libby and Mr. Cheney very nervous.
Well, he's also said that he wants Fitzgerald to come as well.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
So now we don't know whether Fitzgerald will come, but he'd indicated, I think, in the press conference following the verdict that that he would do whatever was appropriate. Now, if he views it as appropriate, then I guess he will come. So
right. That's
very interesting. The other hearing that we're going to have, and I'm not sure which committee it's going to be, but there are going to be hearings about the FBI abuses of the Patriot Act.
These national security letters you're talking about.
The national security letters, yeah. Where we've been finding that, excuse me, my computer's decided to make noises today.
That's fine.
Where apparently agents have not been trained in how they should be using the Patriot Act at all. They're saying that it wasn't deliberate in the sense that there was no malice aforethought, that it's just that people were acting like cowboys throughout the FBI and just using these letters to get information whenever they felt like they needed information.
Without going before a judge and demonstrating that there might be a crime being committed, which is a violation of the Fourth Amendment and the law. However, Bush in his signing statements a year ago this month said, you know, very clearly that he didn't feel that he had to follow that law. So, you know, it's pretty straightforward.
He's very clear on what laws he feels he has to follow and what laws he doesn't have to follow, and the latter is getting to be a fairly small list.
Yeah. I mean, this is from the signing statement. Bush said he did not consider himself bound to tell Congress how the Patriot Act powers are being used. In other words, the FBI doesn't have to tell. And that despite the law's requirements, the executive can withhold information if he decides that disclosure would, and I'm quoting now from the signing statement, impair foreign relations, national security, the deliberative process of the executive, or the performance of the executive's constitutional duties, end quote. That's pretty broad.
That's pretty broad.
Yeah. So, interesting. The whole issue of signing statements is one that I really think needs to be nailed down. I mean, this George Bush rewriting the law, the Constitution does not provide for the executive branch to make law. The executive branch executes the law. They do what Congress tells them to, and they do it within the boundaries that Congress sets for them. And this executive branch seems to think that we've stepped back into time and probably to another continent, and it's not George the Third George to be president of the United States after George Washington, George Bush Senior. It's George Third, the George Third King. You know.
Well, he certainly has more power than Elizabeth II.
You're right. Arguably he has more power than James the First. You know, King James the First, the guy who authorized the Jamestown expedition, which is named after him. You know, who authorized the translation into English of the King James version of the Bible. It was during his king. What do you call it in England? Kingdom?
His reign.
During his reign. Thank you very much. It was during his reign that he threw five knights who were considered, you know, knights were not part of the aristocracy. They were relatively commoners, high status commoners, but commoners. He threw five knights in prison for failing to pay their taxes. And they demanded habeas corpus rights. They said that they, you know, you can't just throw us in jail forever and let us rot. We deserve our day in court. And this led to riots across England, which led to the Habeas Corpus Act of 1639 or 1674, I forget which year it was, it must have been 1639 if it was King James I. And he had to back down. King James had to grant habeas corpus rights to average citizens in the UK. George III here in the United States is saying he's taking away our habeas corpus rights. I mean, that's pretty bizarre when a 17th century British king had less power than George W. Bush.
And in case the listeners are not taking it all the way in, bear in mind that the voters at that time had no vote.
That's right. You're right. It was you're absolutely right. And still, King James had less power than George because he had to acknowledge habeas corpus. Because, you know, the people just stood up in the streets and said, enough already. We're not going to take it anymore.
Well, yeah. There's a difference then, isn't there? Where are the people in the streets?
Well, I think that instead of going into the streets, what they're doing is they're calling their members of Congress, they're joining political parties, they're blogging, they're on the Internet, they're sending emails. I see a groundswell of movement, an enormous amount of activity, and an effort on the part of this government to shut it down, using things like the specter of pornography on the Internet to try and control the Internet. I mean, I think that they're very concerned that the American people are waking up, and it seems to me that they are. They really are. So, time will tell, eh?
Time will tell.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Always great having you on, Victoria. Thanks.
Thanks very much.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. After the break, we're going to be talking with Judge James L. Buckley about what does it mean to be a conservative. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson. The issue today, Jefferson wrote, is the same as it has been throughout all history. whether men shall be allowed to govern himself or be ruled by a small elite. Whether a man shall be allowed, indeed. And ultimately, that's what it boils down to in many regards. And a lot of language is used to describe this issue of governance and self-governance and how does it work and what does it mean. And certainly words like conservative and liberal fall into this. And the word conservative seems to have undergone a tremendous transformation recently. We were talking about this in the second hour of the program, the first half of it. Judge James L. Buckley is on the line with us. He's a former senator, undersecretary of state under Ronald Reagan, judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals. He's the brother of William F. Buckley, who I've interviewed. In fact, some of his words appear in one of my books. Judge Buckley, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've written a new book, Gleanings from an Unplanned Life. And in this, you talk about how conservative doesn't mean what it used to mean. What do you mean by that?
Well, conservatism used to have a very small focus, reliance on folk wisdom, reliance on individual initiative and energy, a suspicion you might say, the professorial class that comes up with instant solutions to a lot of human problems. What seems to have changed recently, and I hope not permanently, is the idea of big government conservatism. To me, that is a contradiction in terms. But nevertheless, we have a president who has talked in those terms, and we've had until the last election the Republican majorities that are supposed to be conservative that have done nothing to slim down our federal government, but on the other hand, have expanded it.
No, but I mean that isn't the beginning and end of it. Your brother used to frequently quote Russell Kirk, who wrote The Conservative Mind in 1953. I'm assuming that you're a fan of the book and
familiar. That I am. Yes.
And Kirk's basic, core principles of conservatism. His first chapter is devoted entirely to Sir Edmund Burke, back the 18th century conservative.
Right.
And Burke's position was that there should be a ruling elite, that was the conservative position, that if the great mass of the people were allowed to participate in governance, chaos would ensue. And that was the position that John Adams took when he referred to our first conservative president, when he referred to the average person as the rabble. That was a position Alexander Hamilton took when he got up before the Constitutional Convention and said that the president should be elected for life.
Yeah, you're taking a long historical view.
I'm talking about true conservatives.
My book didn't go back that far.
Okay. Well, I'm talking, Russell Kirk is echoing these in 1953, and your brother was echoing them in the 1960s when I used to watch him on Firing Line. Firing Line was his program, wasn't it?
He was giving us the history of what he called the permanent things.
Yeah.
That is right. But I don't think in my lifetime anyone who is conservative has talked about reducing the franchise to a certain small property owners and trusting ourselves to a professional, to an
elite.
Well,
I would submit to you that that's exactly what's happening right now. You have over 400,000 African Americans in two states, for example, who were caged last year in violation of a 26-year-old court order against the Republican Party. So that they couldn't participate in elections. You have massive voter disenfranchisement efforts by the Republican Party across this country. That elite has, operating out of the Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon. I mean, doesn't it seem like that's what's happening?
A different kind of an elite than they're talking about. I think the sources you were quoting were, you might call, the natural aristocratic elite.
Right.
And I don't see anyone preaching that today. And I haven't been preaching it myself. I think it's totally unrealistic to expect that in this country. And I am not at all sure that the kind of elite that would arise would be the kind that you and I would be comfortable with. I think one of the most trenchantly wise, thoughtful statements ever made by my brother Bill is that he'd rather be governed by the first 2,000 people in the Boston phone book than by the 2,000 members of the Harvard faculty.
Well, in that he would be echoing Jefferson, and in the day of Jefferson he would have been considered a liberal, not a conservative.
Right.
And so I guess we get back to the question of what does it mean to be a conservative?
Well, My definition and my feeling about a conservative is the person who would rather, in addressing human problems, would rather rely on folk wisdom and the systems and institutions that have evolved over time and survived the test of time, to the brainstorms that would come out of Harvard's social affairs department.
Well, let me give you an example. If you look at the history of indigenous and aboriginal people all around the world, which certainly is the evolution of history, I mean, of tens of thousands of years of America, of human history, you find virtually universally that they care for the sick regardless of their ability to pay, and they care for the elderly.
Exactly.
And they care for the young. I mean, this is just something that has been intrinsic in human societies and only really started falling apart with the Industrial Revolution in a large way.
Well, of course, you're talking about people caring for their relatives.
Well, within tribes and clans, sure.
They were doing that during the Industrial Revolution as well.
To some extent. But the nature of society today is such that, to a large extent, it's just not possible. So modern-day conservatives say we should not have Social Security, we should not have a national health care program in the United States because this is big government. And yet I would submit to you that those two things are absolutely consistent with that folk wisdom that you're elevating.
Well, then you have to, however, decide. You're saying that government ought to look after these things. I don't disagree. Then the question is, which government? Do you turn to the constitutional scheme, which I thought was based on human wisdom and experience, incorporated what used to be called the rule against the rule of subsidiarity, in which governmental responsibilities, including looking after the sick and the poor, would be addressed by the lowest level of government competent to handle it. This approach to government, which is written into the Constitution in terms of the division of labor between the feds and state and local governments, assures that to the extent possible, problems will be addressed by those officials that are closest to the people and most familiar with the exact nature of the problems that need to be handled.
So you're suggesting, well, first of all, where in the Constitution does it say that?
That's the logic of it.
This is a variation on the Tenth Amendment?
No, I gave you the rule of subsidiarity, but the logic of the, if you look at the, at Article 1 of the Constitution and the powers assigned to Congress, they are powers that are arguably only capable of being handled at a national level.
Arguably.
Post office,
but it doesn't say
coinage,
that in the Constitution.
Interstate commerce, obviously.
Right.
And so because people at the time of the ratification debates were concerned about the human proclivity for concentrating power, were concerned that the federal government will get out of control, and therefore insisted in some of the states that a Bill of Rights be adopted.
Yeah, no,
one
I understand.
Of which was the Tenth Amendment.
Exactly, I understand, and I think to a certain extent I agree with you on this. However, at a certain point you have to say some risks are so large that there are many communities across America that couldn't run a local Social Security program or that are too poor to provide local health care.
Right.
And so
address it and see which is the most feasible, least intrusive, most reliable way of handling that. Let's say that take Mississippi, which is always seems to be the candidate for the lowest income for per capita and so on. I don't know if that's true or not anymore. Yeah. But in any event, say, okay, there is Mississippi is incapable of handling its desperate poverty situation at a level that we as a nation feel necessary. Two alternatives. One is to create a vast national program, a welfare program, and apply the same rules throughout the entire United States, taxing the wealthy to support the
I understand. And the other would be to help
or, in the alternative, say, we're going to send money to Mississippi and let the people in Mississippi decide how to spend it for the poor.
Good point. Judge James L. Buckley, his new memoir, Gleanings from an Unplanned Life. Sir, thank you for being with us today. Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, listening for the sponsors, in particular your local sponsors, your local radio station. Let them know you're listening. Let them know you're buying their products. In fact, do it, right? And also our national, supporting our national sponsors, thanks for that. Sacred Grounds Coffee, for example, sacredgroundscoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com. The Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. And Purina One Natural Blends at 1-866-380-MEOW for a free 3.5-pound bag. The Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal, talking about the 10 conservative principles. I would submit to you, I thought that was an interesting conversation with Judge Buckley, and I really wanted to keep it at a fairly high level rather than the level of a fistfight, because he's actually a serious and thoughtful guy, and I think it's really important for us to understand that conversation that I had last week at the CPAC with, as I recall, Craig Bannister, where, in fact, actually, I think the most important part of it came when after we get off the air, when I was at the Conservative Political Action Committee, and he said, you know, you and I both want the same thing. We both want a country where everybody is safe. We want a country where everybody has health care. We want a country where people are secure in their old age. We want a country where people can own their own homes. We want a country where there's a strong middle class. We just differ on our opinion about how to accomplish that. And, you know, spot on. And I would submit to you that the evidence shows that every time conservative principles have been used, the principles of modern conservatism or classic conservatism, either one, frankly, every time those principles have been used, particularly economically, what you end up with is a very small ruling elite and a very large impoverished working class and a relatively small middle class, which is limited primarily to the professional class, I guess. Really, it is the history of liberalism that has brought this country to that brought this country to being one of the most powerful nations in the world before Ronald Reagan started deconstructing it with the conservative revolution in 1981, 26 years now of conservative rule. For example, as John Gray wrote some years ago in his Joe Republican piece, and you can Google this, just Google Joe Republican, you'll find it all over the web. Joe gets up at 6 a.m. and fills his coffee pot with water to prepare his morning coffee. The water's clean and good because some tree-hugging liberal fought for minimum quality water standards. With his first cup swallow of coffee, he takes his daily medication. His medications are safe to take because some stupid commie liberal fought to ensure their safety and that they work as advertised. All but $10 of Joe's medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance, and now Joe gets it too. He prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs. Joe's bacon is safe to eat because some girly man liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. In his morning shower, Joe reaches for his shampoo. His bottle's properly labeled with each ingredient and its amount and the total contents because some crybaby liberal fought for our right to know what he's putting on his body and how much it contained. Joe dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some environmentalist wacko liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting the air. He walks to the subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work, saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees because some fancy-pants liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everyone the opportunity to be a contributor to society. He begins his workday. He has an excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation because some lazy liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. If Joe's hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get workers' compensation or an unemployment check because some stupid liberal didn't think he should lose his home because of a temporary misfortune. It's noontime. He needs to go to the bank to deposit his paycheck and pay some bills. His deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some godless liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system before the Republican Great Depression. Joe has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some elitist liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime. After work, he visits his father at the farm out in the country. As he gets in the car for the drive, his car is among the safest in the world because some American-hated liberal fought for car safety standards. He arrives at his boyhood home, he's the third in his generation to live at a house financed by the Farmers Home Administration. His bankers didn't want to make rural loans. The house didn't have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose where it didn't belong and demanded electrification. His father's now retired and living on Social Security and a union pension because some wine-drinking, cheese-eating liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. He gets back in his car for the ride home, turns on the radio talk show. The right-wing host keeps saying, liberals are bad and conservatives are good. He doesn't mention that his beloved Republicans have fought against every protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout the day. Joe agrees with the conservative talk show host. He says, yeah, we don't need those big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Pick up your calls on the other side of this break. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth to multinational corporations we'd really rather you weren't all that familiar with. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Nova M. Phoenix, 4X.
It never fails, you let the fox run in-house. What did you expect? You've been looking for your chicken, but you ain't seen one yet. The only thing that I don't know is why you're so upset. You let the fox run in-house. That's what you get.
Yes, my friends. And that's what we've done. It's with the Bush administration. Tragic, ain't it? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Time to get out there and get active. By the way, aren't we pleased to know now that we've figured out who the bad guys are in this whole mess that's going on in Building 18, the Pentagon and the Department of Defense and Walter Reed Hospital? According to Congressman Phil Gingrey, the Republican from Georgia, in testimony yesterday before the House Armed Services Committee, the people to blame for the cockroaches and the mice are the soldiers. Well, of course. In fact, that's exactly what he said. He said, and I quote, and of course, if you leave food around in a motel room or a dorm room at a college, you're going to get some mice to show up at some point in time. End quote. He also said, I was glad to know that those cockroaches were belly up. It suggested to me that at least somebody was spraying for them. End quote. Oh, isn't that sweet? Maybe it was Tom DeLay. Mr. Bug Spray Guy. Yeah, right. Leonard in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, welcome to the program, Leonard. What's up?
Well, in response, I can't speak for all of my fellow soldiers, brothers, and sisters in Iraq and Afghanistan and the U.S. Armed Forces of this country. That congressman can go you know where.
Yeah.
If you're listening, congressman, go to H. Go straight there and worship your God, George W. Bush, Mr. King of the United States. My fellow soldiers are dying in Iraq right now so you can save your political behinds to get elected. It's all a political game with you, you low vermin up there in Washington, D.C. I'm calling you, Tom, because down here in Arizona, I'm quite sick and tired of leaders in both political parties who are not doing anything at this time. We have a governor on our front page of the paper of the Arizona Republic yesterday, and I want people to call in. If they can say she was quoted out of context, she was quoted by the reporter from the Arizona Republic as stating that she cannot support a withdrawal of troops, of American troops from Iraq. And furthermore, progress is being made over there. So I would like to know why our Democratic governor, who heads our political party, is in direct contradiction to what we passed in 2005. Our party voted to withdraw my fellow soldiers from Iraq because it is a lie.
Yeah.
So
well, that's a good point, Leonard.
Politicians make me sick.
Yeah, I understand. I absolutely understand, and I am very upset and very disappointed with many of them myself. And what we need to do, and I get it that you're doing that, and I salute you for it. Is we need to convert that anger that you're experiencing into activism. We need to get out there and get active.
Thomas Jefferson was right, though. There's only so much we can take. I believe in nonviolence. But if those rats up in Washington, D.C., and then running our states want to continue sending my fellow soldiers over there, maybe nobody cares because only a small amount of us are dying. But you people are going to understand sooner or later. You're not going to do this anymore to us.
Well, thank you, Leonard. I hope you did not. I will assume you are not asserting violence. Steve in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, earlier I was thinking I'd like to talk about the prisons that Halliburton's building around the U.S.
Yeah.
But actually, what I wanted to talk about, you were talking about bullies. You know, when it's all over and said and done, and maybe the VP and the president will be out of office and maybe be in jail, depends on what the hearings and all that, how are we as a people going to purge the PNAC bullies and the neocons out of the government?
I think it's happening already, Steve.
Rogue I, the Justice Department.
You know, yeah, I mean, you know, we're what, a month, month and a half or so into a Democratic Congress, and the subpoenas are coming now, and there are, last count, 52 investigations. I understand it's more than that now, into potential crimes that this administration has committed. You know, our last caller, I think, represents a level of anger and concern, particularly among people who are foreign and even current military, former and current military, you know, with the disastrous policies of this administration. People are waking up. People are waking up. I mean, look at the polls. What we have to do is translate that into political action. That means getting out there and getting active.
That's correct. And, one other thing, what about those prisons that Halliburton is building?
They are supposed to be, my understanding is that the prisons that are being built all over the United States by Halliburton are to house illegal immigrants in the event of an illegal immigrant sweep, which in all probability, A, wouldn't happen, and B, if it did, it would be a disaster, a tragedy, and it wouldn't at all solve the problem. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem. We have an illegal employer problem.
Yeah.
And these guys always want to try and criminalize the little guy. You know, it's just like the war on drugs. Criminalize the little guy and let's build more prisons. I think it's a profit boondoggle. I am not yet ready to embrace those folks who are convinced that these are these are the American versions of Dachau. The internal prison camps, not death camps, but simply prison camps and labor camps that are being set up for you know folks like you and me.
Yeah,
I'm not there yet.
Yeah,
but
quote unquote enemy combatants.
Yeah, right. I'm not there yet. But the fact that Bush and his administration that and so many of the Republican cheerleaders in this administration have been working so hard to move us in a direction where that could be possible gives me serious pause. And it's one of it is absolutely the one of the most important reasons why I think it's so important that we do get out there and we get politically involved. Steve, thank you so much for the call. Sohad in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Sohan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I just wanted to comment on something you said in the last hour about how most countries in the Middle East, women aren't allowed to go to school or to work. What country were you thinking of exactly?
Well, I was thinking of Afghanistan, actually. And in Saudi Arabia, it's very difficult for women to work. Women are not allowed to drive, for example, in Saudi Arabia. I'm sure you're familiar with that situation.
Right. So two countries out of...
Oh, okay. You're right. Yeah, I stand corrected. In most of the Middle Eastern countries, particularly most of the Arab countries, are the majority of them are probably, numerically anyway, are secular countries, and Iran included, and to a large extent, by and large secular. There's a real battle going on, you know, within those countries between the folks... Just like there is here in the United States, between the Christianists who want to impose Christian law and replace the Constitution with the Bible, and Islamists who want to impose Sharia law and replace constitutions with that. But yeah,
well,
okay, I stand corrected.
Yeah, and just, you know, that's why more Muslim Americans and more Arab Americans don't become involved with progressive politics, because so many progressives cling to the same stereotypes as those on the right.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's very easy to fall into them. At the same time that it is possible to point to, for example, the prevalence of mercy honor killings throughout the Middle East, you find that also in India. When I was in India, I mean, this is a big problem, particularly in rural India. And I would say that you find variations of that in the United States. And so we all have a long way to go here, Sohad. And thank you for keeping me honest. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Frank in Middletown, New York. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hi. I don't know if I can get this across well or not, but I'm going to try. In listening to you talk to Mr. Buckley, and I've heard you talk to other conservatives who try to debate those conservative philosophies, this is paradox between Republicans and Democrats. On the one hand, Republicans, who, I'm sorry, tend to be very mean-spirited and thuggish at times, all their philosophies are based on the fact that men are basically good. If you form laws, you know, everyone will take care of everybody, and you don't have to have many laws because they'll take care of each other and business.
Actually, let me challenge that. The core conservative worldview is that humans are essentially evil, and goes back to the whole notion of original sin, and some would even extend that and say, and women are the cause of that. And therefore, as Russell, not Russell Kirk, as Edmund Burke's, no, not, it wasn't even Burke. It was, who was the guy who wrote about it? Life is short, miserable, he wrote Leviathan. Say it again, Julian. Yeah, Thomas Hobbes. Thank you. Thomas Hobbes, you know, he said, without the iron fist of government or church, then the intrinsic evil nature of man will emerge. That's the core conservative position. The core liberal position is that people are good and decent, and that's why you can trust governance to all the people.
I'd like to debate that for a second, because I think,
sure.
I mean, that's reality, but I think when you listen to them talk, they tell you that the reason we don't need all these laws is because basically people are good and they'll take care of each other.
Well, they Democrats want the laws. They just don't want the institutions.
Democrats, on the other hand, say basically people are good-hearted. At heart, people are good. But when we navigate our laws, we have to base them on the fact that not everybody is good. And
sure.
So we have to protect the weak from those who aren't.
Right.
So Republicans say we don't need laws because they're, you know.
Well, again, let me just recalibrate that, Frank, because I would say that the Republicans don't say we don't need laws. They say we do need laws. We do need police, strong police powers. They want there to be a very, very strong police presence. They say we don't need social institutions like Social Security or Medicare. We don't need.
I'll agree with that.
Yeah. And Democrats would say, okay, let's scale back on the laws a little bit. And some of the libertarians and, you know, who I jokingly, but there's an element of seriousness, refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke pot and get laid. That, you know, they would say, no, let's cue back on some of the laws, you know, for example, this crazed, you know, war on drugs, and let's strengthen some of our institutions, our social and civic institutions.
I think
institutions.
Social you're probably right there. But there is kind of a paradox there that, on the one hand, Democrats tend to understand that men aren't necessarily good.
Sure.
And so we have to kind of make allowances for that.
Right, but we also don't say that all people are evil and that's the intrinsic nature of people. Well said, Frank. Thanks a lot. I guess the bottom line here is that the Democratic Party or that the liberal philosophy is essentially a pragmatic one, and that the conservative philosophy is essentially a dogmatic one. 45 minutes past the hour. More with your calls right back, right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
This is my dad's favorite song. We played it at his funeral this last summer.
I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night, and I think to myself,
what a wonderful world. Thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, to Julian Sukman, to Lauren Kirshner, the folks at Air America Radio, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you. for listening to our program. We got a solid board of calls here and just a few minutes to wrap up the show for this week, so let's try and keep them short. Matt in Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Real quickly, I'm calling to urge listeners to support Charlie Rangel's H.R. 654. This is a bill that would ease travel restrictions to Cuba and is a first step in finally ending the embargo. Thank
That's
you.
You're welcome, Matt. Good suggestion, and thank you for passing it along. Judy in Seattle. Hey, Judy.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about the habeas corpus thing when you were talking about George III passing that into law, and I just wanted to say that he didn't do that alone.
That was
passed by the Senate. And including a number of Democrats, 12 of them, as a matter of fact.
Yep.
And what I wanted, and all this time, I have not heard one of those Democrats explaining to us why they went ahead with this, why they helped pass this.
Yeah. I agree. In fact, when it happened, we're talking about the Military Commissions Act here. I named them on the air. Beyond that, I mean, I tend not to have politicians on the radio on this program unless they're willing to talk to listeners and take hard questions. And the only politician I know who's willing to do that is Bernie Sanders. So,
he didn't help pass it either.
No, he voted against it, of course. I mean, he's been solidly on the side of the people for his entire political career. So, yeah, I think that we need to hold the Democrats there as accountable as the Republicans. And you're spot on right, Judy. And I encourage people to contact their senators and say, how did you vote on the Military Commissions Act? I want to know, because I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to vote in 2008. Judy, thank you for the call. Mike in Long Island, New York. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was in Serbia in the former Yugoslavia a few years ago, visiting my father before he died, and it was explained to me that Slobodan Milosevic had only 30% of the support of the people, 70% against him, yet through complete control of the media, he was able to run the entire country. I wonder if you would agree or disagree that that's what's happening in the country today.
I would not disagree with that. I'm not sure that I would totally agree with it, but I think that because I don't see a political party controlling the media outside of the Fox Noise Machine, you know, the Fox Noise Channel.
Right.
What I see is a corporate structure controlling
right.
the media that really doesn't give a damn whether it's Democrats or Republicans, doesn't have a political ideology.
Okay.
It's just basically all about money and profit. And you know, if wars are profitable, then they're gung-ho for wars. And if peace is profitable, they'd be gung-ho for peace. And that's why I think it's so important that we recapture political power in the United States
right.
so that we can say, if you want to play the game of business in this country, we're all for that. We're you know, this is a nation of entrepreneurs. We're entirely in favor of that. However, you're going to have to play by a set of rules that help we the people, that help and not harm this country, whether you're playing the game of business in the media or whether you're making shoes, whatever it may be. That's the position I take. Mike, thanks for the call. Steve in Miami Beach, Florida. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Tom, I just wanted to say, because I know you ain't got time, just wanted to say that because there's so many biased voters in this country, the Democrats really this year, next year, that is, need to nominate Al Gore for president and Wesley Clark for vice president so they can win by a large enough margin to have coattails and sweep in a bunch of other Democrats.
Yeah, I'm for him. You know, I introduced Al Gore in Portland. He came to do his Inconvenient Truth gig, and I introduced him, and then I moderated a question and answer panel with him afterwards. And when I introduced him as the once and future president of the United States. And the crowd went nuts, and he gave me this kind of dirty look. He says, I'm not sure I would have said that.
but Wesley Clark, you know, on the ticket, they wouldn't be able to say his ticket would be weak on national defense.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Or general.
We'll see. You're right, Steve. We'll see how it shakes out. There's a lot of that's the problem the Democrats have is they have too many good candidates. Now, Susan in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Susan.
Hey. I just wanted to say that you haven't mentioned Newt's affair while he was.
Oh, he confessed
going
it on
after Clinton
on
for
Focus
his.
On the Family yesterday, I guess it was. He confessed that he was having an affair while he was leading the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
I know.
He wasn't the only one. I mean, Bill Barr was and Livingston was. There were like four or five of them who were actively having affairs at the time that they were prosecuting them.
Their hypocrisy amazes me.
Yeah, it does me too. Susan, thank you for the call. Michael in Los Angeles. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Tom. We're all familiar with impeachment. Nixon did it, was impeached, and he...
Actually, he wasn't. They drew up articles, but he was never impeached.
Well, he stepped down. Clinton was, but
yeah.
I'm not sure how one get removed from office.
You have to have a conviction in the Senate. You have to have a conviction in the Senate. Once you have a conviction
of what?
Well, a conviction of the person for the high crimes and misdemeanors. And impeachment doesn't mean removal from office. Impeachment means indictment. And impeachment is the same thing as if the local district attorney says, we're going to charge you, Michael, with robbing a bank. That's identical to an impeachment.
Would and that the House mean that I would have to leave office?
No, that would mean that you would have to show up in a court of law, which is the Senate.
Is there any way that you can force one to leave office?
Well, sure. Actually, if the president was convicted in the Senate, then it would be a simple matter. I don't think that he would stay there. I mean, you know, he couldn't. So I'm not so concerned about that. It's a matter of getting it to the Senate. That's the big challenge. Thanks so much for calling. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back next week with the program broadcasting live today. Special thanks to the folks here at K-Talk, AM 1150 in Los Angeles, for hosting me and this program today. Some really great folks helping out, and it's much appreciated. And we will see you on Monday. And in the meantime, remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.